I'm Dale Jampgar, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And this is my third marvelous week at Holden. I've been coming here for some 14 years, every two or three years, and each time has been a rich treat. So if this is your first time, why, I welcome you to all the treats of Holden. At home, I work as a counselor. Began first as a social worker in my life and worked for a short time as a social worker, then went to the seminary and served a parish in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for 7 years. And hey, we got some Milwaukee. And then I moved to Milwaukee, Oregon, and came there to be the director of life education for Lutheran Family Service, and was concerned then with developing all kinds of ways that people can discover how to live life. Our conviction was that we didn't want to have people waiting until they needed counseling and were in crisis before they could learn some of the things that they found out when they came for counseling. They often would say, why do we have to wait before our lives are falling apart to learn some of the things that we have learned through our counseling experience? So that was my role and task. And one of the things that I did in that capacity then was to develop a program called the Quest Fellowship. And I continue now working with the agency as a director of Quest Fellowship. And we have some of the members here from Portland and Oregon and Washington who are members of Quest. And so you may be talking with them sometime during the week. Quest is a personal growth and change program where people meet in small groups for about 7 months, weekly sessions, and then it concludes with a 5-day seminar. And those who complete that process can in turn then form a group and take them through the same process. And we have between 300 and 400 members involved in these groups throughout the Northwest. In private practice, I do counseling with personal, marriage, and family problems, but also in moving more and more in the direction of counseling people around stress management and around the underlying psychological factors of illness. And in that sense, working with the mind-body-spirit interactions. So what I'd like to do today is present to you a backdrop for the kinds of things that I'm going to be doing in other sessions this week. I call it the Christian and the Wellness Revolution. My son, you know, your children keep you honest, and he says, Dad, that word wellness appears in an awful lot of your titles. What does it mean? And, it's indicative of a number of things. One of the things is that we are coming to realize that health is more than the absence of symptoms, that health involves a total functioning of the body, and that we can grow in our functioning capacity, that we have far more functioning ability than we're making use of. And wellness then is that open-ended invitation to be all that we can be. And it's related then also, you know, a person may say, gee, I'm healthy, I'm well, and then I talk to his neighbor, and he says, he's healthy, he's always critical of his wife, and he's yelling at his kids, and he's complaining about this and that, you know, is that healthy? And so wellness then expands the concept of health to the whole way we live life. It involves more than just the condition of our body. Well, there are other terms that are used. George Leonard writes a book called The Ultimate Athlete. That's his term for wellness. Sometimes we use, well, Jesus said, I came that you might have life, aliveness. Or he says also, be ye perfect, even as your Heavenly Father is perfect. And what he means there is calling us to a full sense of wellness, our full potential. My son, as he reflected on it, he says, does it mean something like self-actualization? Yeah, not bad. Pretty close on that. So, this is what this is going to be about. And what I want to share with you today are some of the things that we can see happening that tell us that we're in a period of revolution and change. And I think a very important one. And then also, after we begin to see the scene and the shifts that are taking place, to raise the question, what does it mean to be a Christian in the midst of this? Does that make any difference, whether we're Christian or not, as we approach the whole issue of wellness? Well, one of the ways of raising the issue is to take a look at what's happening. And one of the things we've seen is that we are very impressed with the successes that we have made in our medical care system. Our medical care system has been essentially a treatment approach, and great strides have been made in understanding medicines and surgery and what can be accomplished. And what I'm going to say is in no way meant to detract from the significance of what we have done. But we need to step back and say, how does that fit into the total need, and are there other directions that we need to go? Because in some ways we have tended to be hooked on our medical system. Well, then one of the ways of raising the question that always gets our attention is, what does it cost? In 1970, health care costs in the United States was $74 billion. In 1981, health care costs were $247 billion. 1982, $287 billion. 1983, $322 billion. In 1982, that is $1 of all the money that was spent for anything, one out of every $10 was spent for health care. Now, to put this figure in a little different kind of perspective, that figure is equal to all that we have spent on our defense system, that we have spent for automobiles, and if you added together the profits of the 41 top oil companies, it would be equivalent to all of that. Now, notice that the rising costs. As people who begin to project this, they're projecting 1990 at $890 some billion. How much can we afford? Where is this going? In 1982, what we saw was inflation of the consumer price index went up 3.9% in an overall way. Healthcare went up 11%. And in many ways, we're having difficulty figuring out how to put any stop to the inflationary rise of healthcare costs. And this, of course, is for many reasons, but we'll take a look at what some of what that's about.
Is that mostly in hospitals and clinics, and or is that medication? Or is that everything?
Well, it includes everything, and of course, the major costs are related to hospitalization and more of our specialized care that is extremely expensive.
And then the medication for it also, or is the medication even?
That would be included, yes. Anything that has to do with health care is included in these figures. Yeah.
Does that include emotional health
yes.
as well as physical?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a broad category dealing with a whole range of costs. I would be hard put to tell you what is or is not included in it, but it's in general, everything that's spent on health care. Now, one of the things, to bring it right close to home, what we realize is that for a lot of individual families, if you get hit with a very serious illness, it can wipe out your whole financial security. And we know there are families who are faced with this. So this becomes scary for families. That's something that is almost beyond their control all of a sudden could affect them greatly. Of course, then it affects, this often affects middle-income people who try to hold the line on how much insurance, but one tragedy like this could destroy them in terms of financial security. Now, we often think of these terms, insurance takes care of it. Well, believe me, insurance companies are really scared at this point in terms of how they're going to be able to function. As I've heard them give presentations, They're beginning to say, we need to draw lines on who can get care and who won't get care. And I'm sure you've been aware that your insurance rates have been going up. They went up 20% in 1982. And another one who is concerned are the employers. And we can kind of lean back and say, well, the employers pay a great deal of these benefits. When you buy a car, a new car today, you will spend about $800 on health care benefits as a part of the cost of that car. So it is not just the employer. It is we, finally the consumer, that is paying the bill. And so far, we haven't seen how we're going to cut these costs, although you may have heard that there is a great deal of cost consciousness in hospitals, insurance companies beginning to exclude certain things that they won't cover, and trying to limit the use of health care, at least the most expensive health care. So this is one major issue for us, and that is that in the direction we're going, we finally won't be able to afford it, to have what we want. Another factor is that with the development of our technology, we are developing far more expensive treatments. And I just want to pick one to give you an idea, the kidney dialysis. Who should have the kidney dialysis program? In other words, it's essential to maintain their life. Should we be willing to deny it to anyone? Or if we don't deny it, it's very expensive, and I don't even have a way of saying that. One way I know of saying it is that the money that we spend on kidney dialysis programs in our country is equal to all the money spent on hospitalization care in France. So it is a major program, and we have begun to have the government involved in subsidizing kidney dialysis programs because we felt, you know, people really should have this. We don't want to deny this to some people. And that's just one program that is emerging as major technology that is going to be able to do tremendous things. You know, the heart transplants and all of this that's coming, and all of the extremely expensive programs. In England, for instance, they have begun to say that a person over a certain age would not be given certain treatments under their socialized medical program. Think of how hard those decisions are to make. We have the way of saving your life or letting you maintain life, but you will not be given it. And yet we're going to have to make those decisions if we're going to control the cost in some way.
Yeah. It's also interesting, I think, to note that most of those technological advances in medicine come from our tax money, which has supported the research that's gone into that. Mm-hmm. And while we may be paying for it today, maybe years from now, those of us that pay for it may not have access to it. So it becomes, I think, an ethical question as well as a technological question, which is moving faster.
Yes. Good point.
One other issue on it is a huge portion of that increase has been in spending money in the last year of someone's life, which means you spend a lot of money and they die anyway.
Yes.
Within a short period of time.
And how much of that heroics should we be involved in? At what expense? And families are often faced with a difficult decision. Should we provide this for our loved one, at which we will maybe wipe out our life savings, or should we let the natural process of the illness go and let them die a year sooner? Some of those kinds of difficult decisions. Now, in some ways, what this is raising is there any other alternative? Are we hooked on, addicted to our medical system or our medical approach? And as we step back and take a look again, for all of the marvels of our technological development, there are the other side of it too, and that is that, for instance, in adverse drug reactions, the adverse drug reactions are responsible for the 11th cause of death. And there's some growing evidence and studies here. that often the treatments or the medicines that we get ultimately can affect us negatively and become a part of the problem. So that, as with all technology, often the answer becomes the problem eventually. Now, let's put this in another context. What this raises is this whole question then is there another approach? And let's take a look at what has contributed to our life expectancy. Now, for about 1,000 years, prior to 1900, the growth in life expectancy moved from the mid-30s to mid-40s, over 1,000 years. From 1900, if you were born in 1900, and then if you were born today, you would have 25 years greater life expectancy today than you would have had if you were born in 1900. So we've changed that much in 80 years compared to the change of 1,000 years. Now, how has this come about? There's been a number of very interesting things. Ed Jenner in 1796 noticed it was the time of the smallpox, which was a rampant, a major killer, and he noticed that the cow maids did not get smallpox for some reason, and he began to wonder why. And he found that usually they had cowpox. And so with this in mind, he was thinking this might be a major factor. And he did something experimentally that we would never be able to do today. He took a 7-year-old boy and made sure the boy had cowpox. And then 3 weeks later, he exposed him to smallpox. And he did not get the smallpox. And thus came about a growing realization. It took time for this to catch on, but a realization of what could be done with vaccinations and immunizations.
What's cowpox?
It's, I don't know. It's a disease evidently related to what was the cow?
It's a virus.
Just an infection, yeah.
It's a similar virus.
And, so anyway, immunization has been a major factor because smallpox is almost totally now wiped out. Not only in this country, but around the world.
It's been several years since any has been found anywhere.
Yes, yeah. So tremendous advance in this sense. Now in 1900, TB was number one of the cause of premature death. And now TB is out of the top 10 and has changed. In 1850, we hear of a man called John Snow. It was a time of the cholera epidemics, kind of come and go. And the cholera affected mainly the lower classes of people. And so one of the interpretations was that this was God's judgment on lower classes of people, and God's wrath was being expressed, which was one of the views of illness and disease. Well, John Snow was a very observant person, and he noticed that people in London, people drinking from this one well were getting cholera, and people in other areas drinking from other wells were not. And he went and took the handle off the Broad Street well and again became aware that water sanitation and good food are a major factor in dealing with illnesses. And diphtheria was third in 1900, and in 1980 there was only one case of diphtheria in this country. Polio, the scare of the 1950s, which probably many of you remember, there were more cases of polio in one day than there were in the last 10 years. So again, with prevention care, we have made major strides, and these have been in inoculations and food and water safety and sanitation, preventative care. Now, another way of taking a look at this is that it's true that our life expectancy is 25 years longer than it was if we were born in 1900. However, if you were 45 years old in 1900 and 45 in 1980, your life expectancy in 1980 would only be 6 years longer than in 1900. Did you follow that? If you were 45 years old, you'd only have a 6-year increase of life expectancy, which tells us that the major gains have been in lower infant mortality and in those early years of life when many died. And so, again, those have been the major gains that we've made. There's a Lester Breslow down in California who did a study of some 7,000, I think all men, and what he was checking on is whether people's general lifestyle had anything to do with their health. And he came up with this in his study. He said he looked at 7 basic health habits. They are: 1, eat 3 meals at regular times each day instead of snacking. 2, eat breakfast every day. 3, get moderate exercise, walks, bike, riding, swimming, so forth. 4, sleep 7 or 8 hours a night. 5, do not smoke. 6, maintain moderate weight. And 7, do not consume alcohol more than moderately. And what he determined was moderate was 3 ounces of alcohol daily. This translates to 2 cocktails, 3 bottles of beer, or 1/2 a bottle of wine. Now, you have to remember, this is Southern California. Anyway, in his study, what he found was those at age 45, those who had 3 or less of these good habits could expect to live to age 67. Those who had 6 or 7 of these habits could expect to live to 81. So his conclusion is that if you want to have a longer life, don't wait for medicine to get you there, that your lifestyle can be a major contributor to how long you will live.
Did he find a positive correlation with every one of those, for example, did he find a positive correlation with breakfast?
I don't have all the details of his study, no. But that would be an interesting kind of question, which of these, how he weighted these. And of course, I think we can recognize that the smoking and the alcohol would be major factors here, as we can notice later. Another way of saying this, you can't do much about how you look at age 16, but you can do a lot about how you will look at age 60. That our lifestyle can have a major effect for us. Now, if we come to 1980, we see that the major killers now, major reasons for premature death are, 1, accidents, 2 is cancer, 3 is heart, 4 is homicide, and 5 is suicide. 3 of the top 5, in a sense, are related to violence: accidents, homicide, and suicide. And as we look down this list, one of the things that is noted is that 1/3 to 1/2 of accidents, and often even heart, homicide, and suicide, are alcohol related.
Say that again.
1/3 to 1/2 of the deaths in those areas are alcohol related. And smoking, a person who smokes one pack a day has a 50% higher hospitalization rate. So the drinking and smoking become major factors in our health care. And one of the, Dr. Fahey, who was director of the Center for Prevention in Atlanta, says that this is much worse than the smallpox and cholera epidemics because, he says, smoking is much worse because it is presented as the answer to life. If you really want the fullness of life, you smoke, through all of our advertising. He says that's much more devious and detrimental in a lot of ways.
The people who are from Seattle, coming over, we listened to a report that a major company in Seattle has just forbidden smoking on the workplace, and one of them was for health insurance reasons, and they did a study that showed that something like smokers were out 10 days a year more than non-smokers. But that just came out, just Saturday.
Yeah, yes.
But that was their reason.
54 million Americans smoke, 33% of adults are regular smokers, and this estimate is last year smoking cost the nation $27 billion. And then it relates smoking to the cardiovascular, the lung cancer diseases, and the pulmonary deaths. So, there is more and more evidence. And just a few weeks ago, I had a fellow that was referred to me who wanted to stop smoking, and he was smoking three packs a day and was having difficulty stopping. And I think he was ready, but anyway, I had one session with him, and he was kind of deeply moved by the session, and so he stopped smoking, and he hasn't smoked since then. It's been about 2 months. And not only that, his personality changed. He became much more jovial and relaxed at work. And I've got a steady stream of people coming out from that company. And the boss is paying for it. He's saying, if anyone's willing to go stop smoking, go see Jap Guard and I'll pay for it. I don't know how my record's going to go here. I can do as well as I did with that first fellow, but it's a whole mood in this company. Well, now, the interest in smoking, for instance, if the percent of smokers in 1964 was the same today, there would be 20 million more smokers. So that's encouraging. We are making ground. And notice this one. In 1950, 55 to 60% of doctors smoked, and they had one of the highest occupational percentages that smoked. And today, they're at 21%, and they're one of the lowest occupational rates. So they have become convinced that smoking is a major factor that needs to be dealt with in their own lives. Now. Let's tune in to some of the medical goings on and see what's happening there. There was a conference at Tarrytown, New York. And Tarrytown is a conference center where they often have different kinds of conferences dealing with kind of major current issues. And the name of the conference was the Changing Doctor-Patient Relationships. And they came out with 10 insights as a result of this conference. Notice number one. Most illnesses are self-limiting. The primary issue in recovery is belief. And that's a growing awareness that our attitudes, our beliefs, our way of looking at life greatly affect the way we function, the way our body functions. We're increasingly becoming aware of the mind-body interaction and the role it will have. And coming coming from our Christian orientation. We have in many ways felt that when Jesus says, your faith has made you whole, your sins are forgiven, take up your bed and walk, that we have said, you know, that doesn't fit the way we understand illness today. We understand it essentially as a bodily problem, and it needs to be treated physically and chemically and so forth. And so in many ways we've said, you know, Jesus must have been doing something miraculous. He must have been doing something supernatural. It doesn't fit nature. He called on God to come in and do something. And yet Jesus himself says, greater things than I do will you be able to do. And when he sends his disciples out, he says, you go out and heal. And they come back and say, we're having trouble with the healing. And he says, oh, ye of little faith. And he's saying, see what's possible. That our faith is related to our wholeness and our health. That there's some essential relationships there. And that's one of the things I will want to be looking at more as we go through this week, is the relationship, especially tomorrow. Faith and wholeness, faith and health. How can we begin to understand that interaction and begin to deal with it? And maybe bring the church back into the whole healing process. Because in a lot of ways we've abdicated. We say, well, we take care of the spirit, and you, doctor, take care of the body or the wellness or the health. And I see there a shifting that's taking place. Now, a second one they came to. The brain is not just the seat of consciousness, but a powerful gland. Our emotional response to illness can trigger up to 2,000 known secretions, which set the internal climate for recovery. That the mind can do a great deal to prepare the body to set in motion the actions that create the climate for healing and recovery. Now, we've known this in some way. You've probably heard of the placebo effect, where in the 40s, it was often talked about as doctor giving a sugar pill because the person, it's all in your head, and if you get a pill, you think you'll feel better, and you do. However, the placebo effect has also been rather miraculous shifts that seem miraculous, where all of a sudden a tumor disappears or something heals very quickly, and we kind of go, we don't know why. It just seemed to happen. And there's been more and more experimenting going on with this. For instance, one experiment took people with pain, and they gave one group morphine, and they gave another group and told them it was morphine, and told them what they thought it would do for them. And 70% of those who received the placebo, which was not morphine, but was just a pill, 70% of them received the same benefits, the pain relief that those who had taken the morphine had received. So that something was involving the belief of what was happening. Another kind of experiment was they had doctors and nurses, and the doctors gave a medicine, and they told the person, you know, here is a great new discovery, it's tremendous, I'm sure it's going to be a benefit to you, you know, really played it up, and gave the person the medicine. And then they gave it to nurses to give to patients also, and the nurse would say, here's something that may be helpful to you. And can you imagine who had the greatest benefit from the medicine? Those who came to believe that it was going to be helpful to them and had some assurance of that. So our belief is a major factor. Another one that has been done is one doctor in this conference reported that when he had people with terminal illnesses, illnesses that were usually thought of as terminal, he would connect them up with someone who had recovered or at least been able to function well. And he'd say, you talk to them. And often they would give them enough hope that it could affect and improve their chances of overcoming the illness. So we're just on the edge, I think, of beginning to discover the potential of the mind in the healing process. And then on the other side of that, we're beginning to explore the mind as the underlying factor, underlying illness. How does our illness grow out of the way we live our life, the attitudes and beliefs that we have? And that still is you know, raising a lot of questions. And because we know there are, for instance, chemical conditions and so forth, but we don't know how the mind is involved in creating those. in a very clear way yet. Now a third one, and this one I think is most interesting for we in the church. The third insight they came up with, healing is also dependent on relationships. Does the patient feel at ease in the world, supported by family and friends, understood by the physician? These things can determine how fast the patient moves from harm to harmony. Can we begin to see the role of a church, a caring, healing community of people that support one another in the midst of illness? I think it has a lot of implications for we in the church. And then, now, one of the issues is that our healthcare process has, in a sense, elevated the physician to almost a godlike position. And in one sense, I think the reason we are willing to pay anything for it is that it has become an idolatry. What do I mean by that? Well, a third insight is that we are responsible in a lot of ways for our illness. And do we want to hear that? Isn't it a lot easier to say, "Doctor, I'm sick, you fix it. You do something about it." Rather than hearing that the way I'm living my life, the things I'm believing, the things I'm doing in life, and the excesses that I indulge in are all affecting my health. I don't want to hear that, because then I need to become responsible. It's much more fun to pay the doctor to be responsible for those things. And in that sense, I believe it's become an idolatry for us. Now, that then is not only not good for us, and there's been certain benefits for the physicians in this, but I'm not here to blame the physician, because it isn't all gravy for them either. And that is that they then feel a kind of responsibility for doing things to people, and as a result of that kind of thing, the AMA currently estimates that 10% of the 500,000 doctors in this country are emotionally or physically impaired and involved with such things as drug abuse, alcoholism, depression. Now, it's not that they're the only professional group that's involved in that, you know, to a high degree, but in many ways, there is a high rate among doctors because of the kinds of pressure I think our whole system puts on the doctor as well, and where they get caught in that. So that our question needs to be called into question from that sense also. And then one more of the insights. And that is the challenge is to move from a narrow focus on disease into the realm of true health care. The doctor then becomes a partner in the search for life-enhancing mindsets and activities. Working together, we can restore our sense of joy and playfulness to heal ourselves and our society. The new definition of health is shared enlightenment. Maybe the doctors will become the new priests of our society. Or do we feel that the church has a role in this whole area of helping people, as it says here, search for life-enhancing mindsets and activities? Can the church become a place where people discover ways to be healthy? There's some major shifts going on then in the approach to illness. And part of this also, for instance, is in the whole area of physics, the dramatic revolution in physics in terms of understanding how things happen. And what I sense is happening is we're moving away from a kind of a mechanical understanding of the body to a much more dynamic, happening, energy-involving system, and that in reality you are just a happening of energy. And then when we begin to understand that, then we have a framework in which we can understand maybe the way a thought can affect energy, and not only through hormonal secretions, but that thought may shape our body. And we'll look further at that in terms of physics tomorrow. Now, let me just pull together then what are we talking about as wellness. What does it mean to be well? What is it that we're looking for? Donald Ardell wrote a book called High Level Wellness. And what I'd like to do is pick out some of the things that he talked about as wellness, and then maybe say them in some of our Christian language, and begin to see some of the parallels between what is being talked about here. First one, he says, is oriented to positive payoffs. Expecting a positive experience or positive response in life. Now that is not too far different than when Jesus says, have no anxiety. What does looking for bad payoffs mean? It means we're anxious. We expect the negative. And he said, instead, recognize that God cares for the flowers of the field and the animals and so forth. Will he not also care for you? Expect that when you live in harmony with the world, that there will be a positive experience, a positive relationship, and trust God in that full sense. Now, second characteristics is responsibility for one's own health. That our condition is in many ways the result of what we do. And in our Christian orientation, then, we talk about the confession of sins. Take responsibility for how you have failed to live your life, or what you failed to do in life, what you failed to be in life. Confess that and be forgiven. Let go of that. And in that sense, take responsibility first, and then let go of it so that you're free to move on. And Jesus then saying, your faith has made you whole. Live in such a way that your wholeness becomes a possibility. Then a third one, Ardell says, develop supportive environments. In other words, build relationships in life. Make friends with the world, is what he's saying. Go the second mile, says Jesus. Love one another, even your enemies. Build your connections. Build a supportive world in which you can live and others can live. A similar kind of concern. Fourth is integrated and balanced lifestyle. Integrated and balanced lifestyle. Are you aware of your excesses? Are you aware of those things in your life that you feel you have to have in order to have life? Well, take a look at them, because often they are addictions. They are things you're hanging on to. And in that sense, they become excesses. Now, Jesus then says to the rich young man, go sell all you have and give it to the poor. I don't think he was saying to all of us, go sell all you have, but he was relating this principle to this particular person, where he was hanging on to his riches. He was so attached to his riches that they got in the way of his being free and having a balanced and integrated life. And so each of us, I think, can kind of identify, what is my addiction? What is my attachment? What is it I hang on to as though I'm afraid if I let go of that, I'll have nothing? And look at that and try to understand what it would mean to let go of that in order that I can bring a kind of balance and integration in my life. Then the next one is the high self-esteem. And we've heard a lot about the importance of self-image, how we feel about ourselves. And often the Christian orientation is seen as helping people have a negative self-image. And it's when we come at it in terms of a legalistic approach where we tell people, you are worthless because. There's nothing that can keep you, destroy that for you. And then the crucifixion says there is nothing that you have done in the past that destroys your self-worth. Finally, you are forgiven if you turn to Christ and accept that or know that. And the resurrection says that there is nothing in the future that will destroy who you are. You will live with God if you but continue in that faith. And this then becomes the source of self-image. It is nothing, we do nothing to prove our self-image. Finally, it's a gift to be accepted and lived with. And two more. One then, conscious commitment to excellence. conscious commitment to excellence. And certainly we find this in Jesus. He just repeatedly said, he says, seek first the kingdom of God, serve God, be ye perfect. Keep inviting us to be all we can be. And then he offers to be right in there pitching with it. Ask and you shall receive, seek and you shall find, knock and it's going to be open unto you. In other words, keep opening up to what's possible in life. And don't let yourself fall back and saying, well, I made it last time, I'm going to settle back and take life easy and ignore any possibilities and be safe and secure and so forth. And shut down our openness to excellence. And that, then hear that as different from legalism. Legalism says you must be excellent in order to be accepted by God. That's a heavy trip. This is quite the other thing. Jesus says, because you are a child of God, let yourself come to life. Not in order to be. Okay, and the last one, implementing a personal wellness plan. Implementing a personal wellness plan. Have you thought about the different aspects of your life? And we're hearing more today. One, dealing with what we take in, nutrition, dealing with exercise, and a very important, dealing with the whole way we react to the challenges of life. And this is called stress management. In other words, yeah, there are a lot of demands, though, but how you react to those things will determine the effect that they're going to have on you. Stress, for the most part, does not cause certain problems. The major cause is how we react. And we can do a lot about that. And then if we turn to Jesus, we hear him say, choose this day whom you will serve. And he says, I am the way. And he also says things like, he who would find his life will lose it. And he who loses his life for my sake will find it. So he keeps inviting us to a way of living life that can be healthy. Now finally, I sense that the Sermon on the Mount is talking about the way of living life. And yet there is a major hooker. And that is, the clue is where he says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. If we only see those things that are most obvious, then everything in the Sermon on the Mount does not really make sense. And I want to talk more with you about this, but this is really a key issue. I think, you know, when we hear turn the other cheek, go the second mile, these kinds of things, we say, Jesus, you just don't understand what life is like today. You know, this is a competitive world, and those kinds of things may have worked back then, you know, 2,000 years ago. But what you're saying doesn't fit today. And the reason it doesn't fit is because of how we see life. And what he is saying is, in order for these things to make sense, you must see that actually the reality of things is the kingdom of God is at hand. And all the implications of that. And only if we see that does the Sermon on the Mount begin to make sense. And Jesus ultimately, I think, we will discover, becomes very, very practical. Okay, let me stop on that note and open it up. What are you aware of in terms of the wellness revolution and being a Christian in the midst of it?
Seems we're getting to a heavy point, euthanasia, a lot of questions asked of a free society where we believe that we have many of our own rights, smoking, all those things were leading to possibly more regulation of our own free society, at least in this country.
More regulation.
Really restrictions on our rights. I mean, mm-hmm. We're looking from a governmental aspect, and people don't like that. We hear that every day in the last 4 years.
So people
more
like
meddling with our own personal lives.
Yes, and that meddling then is coming out of some very difficult questions and issues. I know I've been with a group of pastors meeting in a hospital with some physicians, and there we're talking about who should decide when to pull the plugs, or when to pull the tubes and so forth that maintain a person's life. How long do we keep a person alive? If we can keep them alive essentially as a vegetable for 1, 2, 3 years, when do we decide to stop, and who decides? Does the family, or does the doctor, or should the community have some say? Those kinds of issues, yeah, difficult ones.
The question that raised, and I'm a physician, so I hold this in clipping.
Yes.
The question really comes is, healthcare a right, or is it something you buy?
Yeah.
Society has to deal with that one. And also the issue of what's wrong with death. We all get to do it once. Should we do it with class, or should we do it with struggling and gnashing at the end?
Yes.
And I, of course, face those things every week.
I'm sure you do, yes. They're not easy.
But I think society has to answer those. You won't get them from me.
Yeah, we can't expect the doctor to answer those. We need to begin to take responsibility for some of these issues, and part of it, we need to become aware that they are issues. Oftentimes, people end up faced with these issues, never realizing what's involved. And all of a sudden, a loved one, they have to decide, you know, should we let this person die or not? They often have to do a lot of learning fast at that point to help them make the decisions.
One thing that was brought up on the Saturday morning session, which I think is very valid here, is that just simply talking about death is very taboo in this society. I think one thing that would help us deal with these issues is to bring it out in the open much more, and to face death, to have discussion groups or support groups or whatever, and deal with death as an issue, as a confrontation to what life is about.
Yeah. That we don't have, as for instance, some of the Indian groups had, rituals for dying, a way to die, and what that means. And were some of you here last Saturday night? Lost track of time. Saturday evening. Anyway, Elmer was sharing a little bit about his last time with Jeannie, his wife, who died just a couple of months ago. And she came home from the hospital, thought she had 3 weeks to live, and then it turned out to be, 9, 10 weeks, something like that. And he was sharing the way they tried to be with her and celebrate life with her, and also celebrate getting ready to die in a very meaningful time. Yeah.
I was thinking, there's no easy answers to these problems, but education, I think, plays a very important part, or support groups, that kind of an idea, rather than government regulations on a lot of issues. And I think of it like, just in the Christian faith, God offers us this good life in contrast to the evil, but he always gives us the free choice to choose. And if in these difficult issues we could show people, you know, the good, what we feel is the good, mm-hmm. and then let them be free to make their own choice rather than the government saying this or that.
Mm-hmm. So the government choice comes ultimately at the point where we expect the government to pay for it. That's one of the major points anyway.
Yeah. I have a struggle as to how far to go, thinking which way on a certain issue. You were talking earlier about your mind can really be a major force in how you fight a disease, let's say, and you can actually help cure yourself. On the other hand, I know that there are certain steps to dying, and one's the denial and finally the acceptance. When do you stop fighting and knowing that you're going to be cured and having all this faith, and when do you accept? That is a struggle for me. I don't know where's the middle line on that.
Solomon? Yeah, that's a real issue in terms of, and part of it, I'm sure, comes in really accepting either way. Being ready to live and also being ready to die. I think there's some resolution at that point so that it isn't the threat. Because if we see death as a major threat to us, then our fear often multiplies the possibility of it. that what we fear, we react to in such a way that we sometimes are drawn towards.
There's a little phrase in medicine, no dying patients, there's live ones and dead ones. So everybody's living.
Yes.
Till they're dead. And it's just how you live that counts. It's not whether am I dying or I'm not. We're all dying. You know, if you think you're not, you just haven't taken a little check on the calendar.
Now, Symington's, who have done some work with cancer, Dr. Symington, the husband is a physician and the wife is a psychologist, and they've done work with terminal cancer patients. And one of the issues they raise is that people often have need to make a decision whether they want to live or die. And so it's possible that a person has decided inside themselves that life is no longer worth living, and that the disease then is just a process of them finding a way to die. And that unless they make the decision that they really want to live, often there is no way to change that process, because they've decided at a deep level that's what they want, and they will fulfill that.